All right, here we are with another episode of the High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Good morning, Sal.
Good morning, Ryan.
How's it going today?
Doing great. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Hey, we finally made connections with our guest that's in studio this morning and been trying to get you on for quite a while. So thrilled to introduce Dr. Brett Morris, the Indiana State veterinarian, and looking forward to this episode. We got a lot of ground to cover with you, so thank you for being here.
Well, I really appreciate the invitation. I'm glad we found a date and time that worked for everyone.
Absolutely.
So glad to be here.
It's hard to do.
People are busy.
Every calendar's full.
Indeed. So,
Absolutely. Well, we're going to start you off with questions today like we do everyone, and this ought to be good. I'm looking forward to your answers. So your question of the day today, Dr. Morris, is if you could choose to be on one of the nationally televised game shows, past or present, which one would it be?
Well, it has to be Jeopardy.
Oh,
wow. Right out there.
It has to be Jeopardy. I mean, not that I'm good at it.
Okay.
But I'm a better spectator than participant, I suppose. There might be a column or two I know. But, you know, the genius of coming up with a game show, because we're always looking for answers. But they give you the answer.
Right.
You just have to come up with the right question. And to flip that on its head is really a novel notion. I think Merv Griffin started the show years ago. And so it's always been a favorite. Again, I'm not sure I'd be a very good contestant. I wouldn't get very far, but I enjoy participating by television at least.
Absolutely.
And being a part of the game.
So yeah, it's been on like 50 years probably.
It's been on a long time.
Long time.
But again, the notion that, no, we gave you the answer. You just have to give us the question.
Yeah.
It's really unique.
It is.
A really unique approach to a game show. And it's been, of course, extremely popular for a very long time.
Oh, for sure. Well, I celebrate my three answers that I get right per episode just as hard as the guy who gets $100,000.
That's right. Usually I'm in the negative, but it's fun to play.
I just lay out. Yeah. I'd be that guy that'd be like, are you going to beep in? I'm like, well, I know one.
Yeah, that's right. No, I'm still here. Yeah, I just haven't played yet.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Sal, what would you pick?
I think I'm going to take something a little easier. Probably the Price is Right, you know, something without a lot of, I can't get embarrassed too badly on it. I mean, if I don't know the price of a bag of potatoes or something, that's not going to be. But, you know, the big showcase showdown.
It's a lot of fun.
Spin the wheel.
Yeah. I always wanted to do the mountain climber game.
I
thought that was
the
fun.
Music.
Yes. The little yodeler guy.
Yeah. I thought of that one. Yeah.
That's good. That's fun. That's
but
fun.
I think the price is right. I'd like to spin that wheel, just see what happens.
Spin the wheel. Okay. Come on down.
Yeah. That would be fun to have your name drawn on that one. So. I think we play a game at home called Telestrations, and you draw pictures, and you guys are probably familiar with that game. So I think I'd like to do win, lose, or draw.
Yeah.
I don't know any game that would be any more fun, but as absolutely frustrating as that game is, because I heard a comedian one time and he was like, you know, when people don't get it, what's your instinct? You draw it harder.
Yes.
You draw it darker. Even if they're not on the right path, they're like, if I just continue to draw this and point at it, and they're going to get it eventually. So yeah, I think like win, lose, or draw, or Pictionary, any of those.
Pictionary, that's what the home version of that is.
Great
it's just
choice.
That's a fight starter.
A fun game. Yeah.
If you ever want to find out how your marriage is, do
play that game.
Yeah. Put it to the test.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's fun stuff. So, hey, good question. And so we'll get started. So, Dr. Morris, give us your background. Where are you from? Education, career path, and how long have you been the state veterinarian?
Oh, my. You're going to make me go back. I'm actually a Boone County native.
Okay.
I grew up just east of Lebanon in Boone County. And through the school's consolidation programs many years before me, and ended up going into Hamilton County to Sheridan High School. So I graduated from Sheridan High School and then on to Purdue from there. And I was a first-generation college student to take in Purdue, had no idea what I was doing. And I went up there and started in the animal sciences program, wanted to be a veterinarian. I had a great mentor in Lebanon, Dr. Russell Harden, who just passed away a couple of years ago at 100 years of age, and he was my mentor all those years. So I headed off to Purdue and was successful in getting into the veterinary program and finished that program. And while I was there, actually in my pre-veterinary days, I was trying to differentiate my application because there were hundreds of applicants for the veterinary program. So I was on the Purdue campus, and in Lilly Hall at the time, they had job postings on the job board, and one of those jobs was working on a ranch in Nebraska in the Sand Hills. And I said, well, I think I'll see if I can get a job.
Out on the very west side,
on the very west side. So I ended up going to call the ranch owner out there, and he said, you're calling from where? And it turns out they'd put it on the extension wire at the time, and they had sent it all over the country, and I had seen it at Purdue. So I worked the ranch there.
He was expecting somebody from 4 miles away.
Yeah, that's right. Somebody in Alliance, right. Nebraska.
That's exactly right. And, you know, for someone to be calling from Indiana, he said, you must have the wrong number. So I had a very enjoyable summer out there and was successful in getting into the veterinary program. Did my externship as a senior in the veterinary program in St. Francis, Kansas, worked in a beef cattle practice in Northwest Kansas. So that was my intention. I was going to go west and work the cattle industry and the ranches and all that sort of thing. And so by the time I became a senior, I said, well, maybe I've been a little narrow in my focus. And I always enjoyed working with people and people that appreciate animals. And so I looked into positions in various locations and ended up with the state of Indiana. So I went into public service. My classmates thought I was absolutely crazy. I was throwing my degree away that, you know, if you're not going into clinical practice, then there must be something wrong. So I said, well, as long as I'm enjoying it, I'm going to stay with it. And I just last month celebrated 40 years
for
the state
years.
Of Indiana. So wow. It's a blast. I really enjoy it. I work with great people. Get to work with producers and veterinarians of all type across our state and country, and have been in international forums as well. So it's really a wonderful opportunity. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And so I've been actually state veterinarian for 30 of those 40 years.
Wow.
So I've been involved in animal health programs, food safety initiatives, animal welfare, all sorts of things. So it's wonderful, and I've had a great team of people to work with, and of course, working for folks like you out across our state really makes it enjoyable.
Great. Well, I may have missed it. Farm background?
Farm background. Farm grew background. Up in rural Boone County.
Okay.
Yeah, not a big farm, but grew up in a rural part of the state. You know, as it turns out, I lived on a gravel road out there, and we used to, back in those days, we would oil the road in front of the house because the dust was so bad, and the house didn't have air conditioning, and I could see my mother running out, and she would flag down the grader and others and say, you know, don't tear up the oil,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
because
leave,
we just
leave
oil.
The oil.
So, you know, people think that's from the dark ages, but, you know, live on a gravel road,
yeah,
in rural Boone County, yeah, and great place and great place to grow up. I had five brothers. So there were six boys in the family, so we were busy doing lots of things.
So your mother was a tough lady.
She was tough. I have an increasing appreciation for my mother, yes, as time goes by. So, but anyway, a great upbringing, Boone County, on to Hamilton County, on to Tippecanoe County for Purdue, and then now have a responsibility statewide, and it's really enjoyable.
Outstanding.
But your office is at Purdue. Is
actually,
that right?
Our offices are on the state fairgrounds.
Oh.
So we're a state agency, so one of over 60 state agencies. So we're actually located in what was formerly the Girls 4-H Dormitory on the Indiana State Fairgrounds. And the building had fallen in disrepair and had been closed for about 20 years. And we were looking for a place to locate our offices and didn't want to be in the downtown complex because we do get trailers of livestock occasionally and that sort of thing. So they said, well, how about the fairgrounds? So Cindy Hoy, the executive director of the fair, was very helpful and built out some of the space in that former Girls 4-H dormitory. And so it's worked out extremely well. We've been there about 10 years now.
Neat.
So your office will be busy next 2 to 3 weeks.
Yes, the fairgrounds is
oh my goodness,
amazing. Yeah. It is really busy. A lot of activity. The midway's built out. Everyone's, of course, it'll open on Friday.
Sure.
And so
the ham breakfast.
The
sure.
Ham breakfast to
absolutely
get things started. So, yeah, it's an exciting time. It's also interesting to me to see the fairgrounds. I try to walk around the grounds once a day, weather permitting, just to get out of the building and see what's going on the grounds. And, you know, most people know it for the state fair, but there's a lot goes on,
yep,
on those fairgrounds every year.
Hockey games.
Oh, there's hockey, yeah, and all sorts of special exhibits and activities. And, of course, the new Farm Bureau Fall Creek Pavilion, that's a swine barn. It'll always be the swine barn to me. But now that it's enclosed, it's an indoor track facility during the winter. And so there's just a lot going on those grounds. And so it's fun to see those activities throughout the year.
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Marsh, how does your office, so you just physically move, but how does your office interact with some of the other state agencies? And I think probably also, where does Indiana fit, I guess, in the country? And then you mentioned, you know, just some of your international. After that length of time, you've got to have connections almost probably globally, right? I mean, that's, yeah, I guess just kind of jump into that as how does your office work, I guess, with us or with the other agencies?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. And we work with several state agencies, it turns out. For example, the Department of Natural Resources. We work with them because we're the Board of Animal Health, and so there are animal health issues and wild populations.
Sure.
And so we work with them, whether it's dealing with deer issues or it's testing fish in the waterways of the state because there are diseases of fish that we follow. So our Department of Natural Resources have been a great colleague. And, of course, you've had Don Lamb here, so our Indiana State Department of Agriculture. We interface with them on a number of policy issues as well. As a matter of fact, we've been talking about budgets in the next legislative session, et cetera, and so there's a lot of policy issues around that. We also work closely with the Department of Homeland Security, because we established a program several years ago for animal issues in disasters. So if you end up with tornadoes or floods, so what do you do with pets or livestock in disaster situations? And so we established those arrangements some years ago. We actually host a program, a training program called Animal Issues in Disasters, to work with local officials on how to deal with those kinds of issues. So it's a number of state agencies that we're specifically involved with. We've had a great relationship, for example, with the Indiana State Police. So if we get highly pathogenic avian influenza in southwest Indiana, they'll actually courier those samples through their troopers or either cruisers or helicopters to get them to our diagnostic laboratory at Purdue. So there are a number of agencies involved. We work closely with the governor and his team. And, of course, with the years that I've been involved, worked in six different administrations. And so it's been fun to work with all those agencies. Then you get on the federal side, you have all the federal agencies. So since we have the state meat inspection program, you interface with USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service that does federal meat inspection. We also have the dairy inspection program. So that's the Food and Drug Administration. Oh, so you interface with the Food and Drug Administration, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, et cetera. So there's all these interfaces of state and federal agencies that goes on behind the scenes. And for the most part, very seamlessly. You know, it's been a great collaboration over the years with all these partners, because no one entity can do it. So it takes all these partners to be successful. And frankly, sometimes those other agencies may not understand or fully appreciate the role of agriculture in our state. And so it's important to keep educating the other agencies as well. I said, no, this is how we work. This is how agriculture works. And it's real enjoyable. And of course, as you well know, agriculture is a big deal in India.
It is.
You know, and so we produce, I've got one in front of me here, we've produced for a number of years what we call the placemat. And for obvious reasons, we go to a meeting and spread these around the room. But it's just a quick one-page annual report of what the Board of Animal Health did in the previous year, because people don't know what the Board of Animal Health is even about. But with agriculture in our state and the rankings that we have, you know, we're number one in veal production. You know, we're number one in commercial ducks. We're number two in eggs. I mean, that's 11 billion eggs.
Oh,
and we're number two in the United States
wow.
in egg production. We're number two in what they call egg type hatch. These are the chicks that are hatched that become the laying hens. So we're number two in the country in that. Number three in turkeys. I mean, it's hard to imagine that number three in turkeys and number five in swine. So we're a major animal egg commodity state. And that doesn't include mint and tomatoes and corn and soybean, because
right.
I don't do plants.
Right.
But there's all those and hardwoods and all those other things as well. And it always strikes me that we have those rankings in the state that's the smallest state geographically west of the Appalachian Mountains. So we're not a big state, but we've got a lot of ag going on in this state. And so it makes it fun. I mean, there's just, and so when you present this kind of information, even to the governor's team or to legislators or Kiwanis clubs or school groups or whatever, they said, gosh, we didn't know that. I said, I know.
That's fascinating.
And so there's a lot going on in our
state. At our audience, we try to target those who aren't as familiar with ag. So any other statistics that you want to throw out there, I mean, especially we think about the consumer who lives next to a farm or in our community that doesn't necessarily farm. I mean, I'm sure you've got some stats that would just blow them away. But
it's amazing how it's evolved. And it's always interesting, because I'll go to a group and present this kind of data. And I always like to ask the group the question, so what do you suppose that is? Why would Indiana, the smallest state geographically west of the Appalachian Mountains, rank in the top 10 in all these categories? The value of our international exports on an annual basis ranks in the top 10 in the United States. So why would that be? You know, it's always interesting. I don't know if there's any one right answer. It's a combination of things. But so it's interesting the kind of answers you get. And they say, well, it's transportation. I said, yeah, that's right. I mean, we're the crossroads of America. We have a lot of interstates. We can move around. The governor says that there's well over $1 billion worth of road work going in Indiana. And I teased him. I said, well, apparently it's only the roads I drive.
Right. Yeah, see it every day. I got to believe you 100%.
Right out in front of our office.
Right, yes, you can't hardly get here.
I had to box around a little this morning. But transportation is a big deal. So then they talk about, well, it's property tax and it's skilled labor and it's our research and education institutions and that sort of thing. One that came up is water. I mean, we have water. I was in Texas not too long ago at a meeting, and he sat at dinner with tables of eight, et cetera, and they're talking about their oil. And I said, well, look, our oil in Indiana is water.
It's water.
I mean, we've got water. So we have feedstuffs, we have transportation, we have skilled labor, et cetera. So it's all those contributors. So I was actually given the same talk at Purdue one time, so I asked a group of students. So I said, so what do you think? And we went through the same list of things that they contributed. It might have contributed to why we're ranking in all these categories. So there's a young man sitting on the front row, and he said, well, I think I know why. And I said, well, what's your answer on why we would rank? And he said, well, I think you've established a regulatory environment where these companies can thrive. And I said, I think you're right.
I think, I believe, sir, you are correct.
The young man was from China.
Oh.
And so they've seen something here. I mean, it was obvious to him there were some things happening in Indiana. So I'm proud of what we have, and I know you are too. But we try to share that message just as you are here today.
Absolutely.
There's a lot going on in agriculture in this state. And if you're in downtown Indianapolis, no, you probably won't appreciate it.
But you do hear about it. I mean, Mitch Fraser does a great job of talking about the Corteva and the Elanco's and all of that, deciding that this is where we want to be with our headquarters, and so we should definitely be happy about that.
That's right. Well, and the Elanco headquarters is another great example.
Oh, my.
Oh,
for you.
To have a global headquarters in Indianapolis for number two animal health company in the world is really phenomenal.
Yeah, outstanding. Outstanding. So you touched on it just a little bit, but one that's front of everybody's mind is the high pathogenic avian influenza. Now. So walk us through the process of your office. When something like that hits, let's say we don't have it yet, maybe, but what happens as soon as you think you've got a case or prove you have a case in your lab?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that's front of mind for a lot of us right now. And we have worked with producers of all types and veterinarians across the state to say, you know, let us know when something's unusual, when something's out of the ordinary. I tell them the story when I was a senior in veterinary college. Each morning I go down to the large animal clinic to see if you had a case that day. And there was a clipboard down at that office, and it would say that you had a case, et cetera. And so sure enough, one morning, Marsh had a case, and I had Dr. Bain was a clinician on a case, and it was a dairy cow. And so in the far right-hand column of that clipboard was a remarks column. And in the remarks column were three letters, ADR. And I didn't know what that meant. So I went to Dr. Bain on the case, and I said, you and I have this case. We're supposed to work up together, and it's a dairy cow. But it says in the remarks column that something about ADR. I don't know what that means. And he said, well, you will by the time you graduate. Well, it turns out ADR stands for ain't doing right. So I don't know what's the matter with her. She just ain't doing right. So
I'm
we brought
here
her
leaning, leaning on the front of my seat. I'm like, what is this?
Yeah.
So that's what basically we ask people to report. Boas in the ADR business. What's out of the ordinary? Hmm. Producers know their animals better than anyone else when they're off feed, when they're dying, when something's out of the ordinary. That's when you give us a call because we're looking for the ADRs. What's out of the ordinary? So similarly, in high path avian influenza, now in this case, in poultry, it's been so lethal that they generally see mortality. I mean, they see dead birds. And they may have common mortality, and then it takes off, so you're seeing unusual mortality in populations. So they give us a call. And this could be true whether it's someone with six chickens in the backyard or someone that has a million layers. So we get calls from all types. But once we receive that call, then we'll get samples from that site and get them to our diagnostic laboratory on the Purdue campus. The Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory at Purdue is the only one of its type in the state. And so that's where those high consequence samples go. they're able to do that testing there to give us a preliminary result. If it turns out to be what we call non-negative, so it's otherwise positive, then they'll send it off to the national laboratory to confirm it. But since we have those laboratories in the state, and there was a time we didn't, we had Purdue's laboratory, but it wasn't recognized as a place to get that initial diagnostic work done. And that was really one of the outcomes of 9/11. Because we'd talked about using state-based laboratories for initial diagnosis for a long time. But having that capability is really, really helpful to people in my role because I can at least get a preliminary result out of Purdue. You can confirm it later, fine, but I need to start working now. And to be able to use those state-based laboratories has been a great resource. So we get those results. If they happen to be positive or, let's say, non-negative, then we inform the producer and we start the process of quarantining the site for depopulation in the case of poultry. So we'll depopulate the affected sites. We put up a 10-kilometer circle around that site and test and quarantine all the poultry sites within that 10-kilometer area, 6.2 miles. Then in addition to that, we'll go out 10 more kilometers and do surveillance on all the poultry flocks around those. So making sure we haven't missed anything. And this is true whether you have commercial birds or backyard birds. So either way, we're going to test.
So did you do the monitoring yourself, or did you rely on like the flock managers from poultry operations or the people who own the backyard flocks? Do you do that monitoring yourself?
We do both.
Okay.
We do both. So we'll utilize if there's a commercial company that has staff that can sample their own birds, that's great. We'll take that. We often do all the backyard work door to door. And so we put flyers into the community and said, hey, we'll be coming around. And people have been great. You know, they're really great. I mean, people with six chickens are as passionate about their chicken as someone that has 50,000. And so they want to make sure their birds are well as also. So we do all that sampling in those areas on an ongoing basis until we depopulate the affected site, get it cleaned up, and get it back in business as quickly as we can.
Good.
When there is an outbreak like that, I guess with the avian flu, how does that get here? I mean, it seems like it just kind of happens. And is there a commonality between how it occurs? Does it come? How does it show up?
Yeah, that's a great question because some people say, well, it seemed like it's falling from the sky, and it's pretty close because it's actually moving in the wild migratory waterfowl. So these geese and ducks that fly over our state as well as all over the country on the flyways, as they come either migrating north or south through our state, that's where that virus is harbored in those wild migratory waterfowl. And so as a consequence, that's why biosecurity is so important on these production sites, because we have to keep it out. These turkeys and chickens are not outdoors running around in commercial operations, but they're getting exposed otherwise. And it's always challenging to try and figure out how it gets in the building, whether it's, you know, manure on someone's feet, or it's truck tires, or it's intakes, air handling systems, ventilation systems in buildings, et cetera. So we're looking at all those possibilities. But your question's a great one. It's actually moving across our continent in these wild migratory waterfowl.
Just the waterfowl.
It's in those birds. And so there's ongoing surveillance in those wild birds through USDA's Wildlife Services branch and also our Indiana Department of Natural Resources. What's going on? Are we finding the virus? Has the virus changed? Those kinds of things. So that ongoing surveillance of wild birds is happening all the time. Huh. That's great.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's great. So best management practices, you probably have these in place for any type of disease that you might see. And we're talking about the avian influenza because it's top of mind. It makes the news every day. But there's a lot of things out there. I mean, people are constantly monitoring the health of their animals. So if these best management practices, are you consistently updating those? I mean, I suppose you're on the front of your game, and I assume the satellites link up and you talk to everyone. Once they begin to see an issue, you're like, hey, that is definitely become front of mind for us, and here's how we handle it. And I suppose you refresh your staff all the time.
Absolutely. It's ongoing training. There's something new all the time. And then you get a curveball like high path avian influenza virus in dairy cows. Had never been diagnosed before. So suddenly it's the virus we've been dealing with, but it's not the same species anymore. And so when this started in the early part of this year, we received notice from the state veterinarian of Texas, and he said, I've got something going on, and I don't know what it is.
ADR.
It was an ADR. That's right. And so as it turns out, the producers and the dairy producers in the Panhandle of Texas and their veterinarians have said, you know, we've run every conceivable test, and we don't know what's going on in these cow herds. We see a drop in production of about 20%. We've got 10 to 15, 20% of the cows sick. We're not sure what's going on. I was on a call in earlier this year with a diagnostician out of the Texas A&M's Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and she ran down through the list of tests that they had run, and they had run everything trying to figure out what was going on. As it turns out, some samples were sent to a diagnostic laboratory at Iowa State, and they said, well, let's see if it's H5N1 virus, the avian influenza virus, and it was. So it was a unique and unusual finding, and that's how this all started in the dairy side of things. Now, why the Panhandle of Texas, and why now? Because this virus has been flying, literally flying over our country for a couple of years. And so why it located there? But they believe, based on what we call whole genomic sequencing of that virus, that it was actually an introduction from wild birds. It's that same virus into a dairy herd in the Panhandle of Texas. So again, to your point, we're constantly looking for these ADRs, things that are unusual, trying to figure out what they are. Some are things that we've dealt with before, but on the other hand, we're always looking for foot and mouth disease or African swine fever or classical swine fever, et cetera. So there's a whole host of foreign animal diseases that could be a problem. It's just high path avian influenza, to your point, is just kind of front of mind right now.
Sure. And ASF has been, the African swine fever has been in years past, obviously. We've been very fortunate. And there's work at the borders. I mean, that's travel, packaged meat, and the whole nine yards. I mean, you have to watch all fronts. I mean, you guys are guarding 360 degrees on all of those kind of things.
And there's been
that's a devastating thing.
Oh, it'd be.
It would be devastating.
It truly would. That virus had never been diagnosed in the United States, so we clearly have naive populations of swine.
Yes.
And so if it were to ever get in. But to your point, there's been a lot of work done, particularly and intensified after the Dominican Republic was diagnosed with African swine fever, not far off our shore.
Yeah.
And so then you get the island of Espanola down there with Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and there are so many issues in those countries to deal with that African swine fever is not top of mind for them.
Gosh.
I mean, the economic situation in some of those countries is really, really tragic. But nonetheless, there's a lot of efforts to keep it out of the continental United States.
With, I guess this kind of leads me to another question. So, like how we, Dad and I was driving down the road this past weekend, and he always makes the comments about, you know, the fence rows are all gone, but he'll say that there's as much livestock in the county as there ever was, but they're in the hog barns or the turkey houses. And the hog barns today, and I made the comment back to Dad, I was like, well, the hogs are cleaner, you know, than they used to be. People don't know that because they can't see in a hog barn. But this California Prop 12, I mean, people that don't understand agriculture don't understand the care that's involved in these houses, the barns that the animals are kept in. And it kind of struck me that part of the reason to keep them here is it's beyond economics. It keeps all these bad things that can happen to them in the environment. It keeps them out. So what is Prop 12, and why is that kind of the boogeyman, I guess, for ag?
Well, it's certainly something that changed the landscape, didn't it? So Prop 12 was a ballot initiative in the state of California that was passed by the citizens of California in 2018 that basically established housing requirements. And we talk a lot about swine, but there were actually housing requirements for egg-laying hens and calves, veal calves, and so that's all part of that package as well, to increase the size of any of housing for those species in the state of California or anyone who wants to ship specific pork product, for example, to the state of California. And so therefore, it sent waves out across the country and said, well, not only is it a condition of pork producers, for example, in California, but anyone who wants to ship to our state, these specific pork products have to meet these conditions. And of course, there was a great deal of conversation about it while it was being debated in California and eventually voted on. I think it's somewhere around 62% of the population of California voted in favor of it. And so the National Pork Producers Council challenged it, and it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they came down last May, I believe it was, and said they found for the state of California. So it stood. And the National Pork Producers Council had used what was called the Commerce Clause.
Yeah.
And so they said, well, that's a violation of the Commerce Clause under the Constitution where a state places additional conditions. But I think, as I read the opinion, I'm not an attorney by a long shot, but it appeared that if they had placed that condition only on imported swine, but they also placed that condition on pork producers in California. So it wasn't just those outside the state, but it was those inside the state. So then they determined that the Commerce Clause wasn't in place or wasn't germane in this case. So there's a lot of now adjustment and evaluation, because in order to change housing, to your point, Sal, and operations out across our state and across the country, if you were using gestation stalls, for example, and said, well, we can't use those in order to ship into California, I know it's a major decision on the part of producers to how economically to accomplish that task to maintain that market. And of course, California, I think, is like 27th in pork production, mm-hmm. So they're not a big pork-producing state. So most of their product is imported. Therefore, a lot of product.
It affects a lot of people.
It affects a lot of people.
And that's a twofold issue, because it's not only the money you have to invest in changing the barn around to adhere to those guidelines, but in doing so, with the additional space and less animals, I mean, your production's cut by 20% or whatever that number is. So it's a compounding issue.
I think so. And whether we see more of those, and of course, Indiana's not a ballot initiative state, and so, but we do have states like that have ballot initiatives around us, Ohio and Michigan and others. So, but that doesn't mean a legislator could introduce a similar kind of bill through our process in Indiana that says, well, we need to change up the housing situation for swine or poultry here in the state. But there have been a number of adjustments. I know that producers have taken a hard look at it and trying to determine what next best steps they should take. And again, not only on the pork industry, but we have a lot of laying hens, as I mentioned, and a number two in egg production here. And so, and over the years, the egg side of the house, so to speak, that commodity, they've done more and more work on cage-free housing. So there's a lot of cage-free birds in the state now to satisfy some of these specific markets. But yeah, it's a game changer. It's something that that may actually, after the court's opinion last year, we're just a year beyond that court opinion now, may continue to gain some momentum across the country.
So given that, and we think about how agriculture is a decreasing number of population who participates in ag. I mean, it's clear to say 100% participate in ag by eating, but as far as the production side of it, what do you see impacting livestock production in the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, I'm sure you have to strategize and think. You try to stay ahead of all this.
Yeah, but even though we're in the government and doing the regulatory side of things, yes, trying to anticipate what this looks like as we look into the future. You know, when the dairy inspection program was moved to us, to the Board of Animal Health from the State Health Department, it used to be at the State Health Department, there are about 2,500 grade A dairies in the state, and today we're about 680, but we have more milk. So the productivity on these sites is really quite phenomenal. So we just doing as much production or more production with fewer sites, and there are others can speak more eloquently about carbon footprints and all this side of the equation, but nonetheless, very productive sites. The animal productivity, whether it's nutrition, housing, genetics, et cetera, has totally changed the game over time. Similarly in swine or in egg production, et cetera. So we've seen all those changes. But I think as I go back to the response from the classroom student about the regulatory environment, I think it's critical. I mean, so can we produce here in the future? Is Indiana a place where we'll continue to produce? And those are pivotal decisions. And we'll need to be a part of that debate and discussion as we move forward. And we look at Indiana, and there are areas of the state where it might be easier to place a swine operation than in others. Similarly, there are places in the country where it will be easier to place a swine operation than others. And so some are more inviting to animal agriculture. And so I think that'll be an important part of for all of us to keep that front and center, to make sure we can maintain that base. We have, for all the reasons we mentioned, we have the resources to continue to do it. We've been at it a long time. We have experience in the water, the feedstuffs, the transportation, et cetera. But I think the legislative environment is going to be critical for us to continue to watch. I think we need to be wise about our other resources, whether it's soil, land, water, all those areas as well. That's what got us here. We have productive ground. Yeah. We have water resources, et cetera. We need to protect those as well. So I think those are going to be critical ones for us. And making fundamentally the decision, are we going to be an ag state or not? We are now, and we're a major player. But there will be some pivotal decisions over time on whether you continue to maintain that role. And for me, in my opinion, I mean, this is, you know, we've talked about the breadbasket for years. I mean, this is some of the best in the world, and we shouldn't abandon that.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Marsh, is there anything else that's kind of front of mind with your office, or I guess with any other initiatives? You mentioned a little bit about some just your global network, or is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't covered already?
Well, I think it's important that, pardon me, the kind of issues that we deal with in Indiana, pardon me, go on all across the country. So there's a group called the National Assembly of State Animal Health Officials, all the state veterinarians. We met by phone just yesterday, for example.
Really?
So we're constantly working these issues because these viruses know no boundaries, and so they can be all over the United States. So we need to work together, and I think that's important for people to know that we do work together. And so not only is it national, but it becomes international. So I'll be at a meeting in September in Ottawa, Canada, for example, to talk about African swine fever. Because it's just not an Indiana or a U.S. issue, it's a continental issue. So we'll have representatives from Canada and Mexico there to make sure that we're doing all we can to protect and preserve our agricultural assets on the continent. And then I had the good fortune to go to the World Organization for Animal Health meeting, which is based in Paris, France. And so it's been a few years ago I had an opportunity to go over there. So you have over 160 countries that convene to say, so how should we work together globally on animal health issues? And so they have a general session each May in Paris. I know the Olympics are going on there now,
right,
but
sure.
In May there's this general session. So to your point, Sal, there's a lot of interconnectivity globally to make sure that we're doing all we can to preserve and protect the agricultural assets of the globe. And the ability to trade freely these products. Now, there are always challenges, and there's a process to go through WOA, they call it, the World Organization for Animal Health, to try and level that playing field. And that needs to be utilized once in a while, but it's a great opportunity to interface with international and all across our country, the efforts in place to preserve agriculture for our country. And we're fortunate to be in a position where we don't rely upon imports to feed our populations. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
You know, we import a lot of things, and we import a lot of food products. But on the other hand, we can rely upon ourselves to take care of our food needs as a nation. And I think that's really critical for us moving forward as a nation.
A lot of other countries can't do it. They don't have the water, like you said. They don't have anything. Some of the island countries, they have to import all the grain.
That's right. That's right. So we're really fortunate. So I think it's important, again, that we preserve and protect what we have and continue to enhance it. Yeah, there'll be challenges. There'll be curveballs, and that come our way. But we'll persevere. We'll find a way to figure that out as we have over the last several decades and a couple of centuries here in this country. So I'm bullish on it. I think there are great things happening now and into the future, and Indiana's going to be a player in agriculture for a long time.
Great. Well, I don't think we could thank you enough for being here. I mean, this is fantastic. I could listen to you go all day, and I hope you'd entertain the idea of coming back. But Thank you for shining a light on the Board of Animal Health and your position and what you do for Indiana, and shine a light on what Indiana does. So, for sure, it's a great time spent. So, you got anything else for
I've got lots of other stuff, but we'll wait till the next time.
We'll have him back.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have him back. We know your calendar's packed. We'll try to get on a little quicker next time. So, Dr. Marsh, thank you so much for being here, and that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies.